You're listening to the Youth Crit Podcast on KHZ Network. Find us on Facebook at DecibelUNG Radio and find us on Twitter at DecibelUNG. If you like this episode, please leave a like and comment on our iTunes page at KHZ Network. And now for the podcast.
Let me ask you something. What's the most you ever lost on a coin toss?
Look, I need to know what I stand to win.
Everything. Just call it friendo.
Willen, what's in the satchel?
It's full of money.
He's just a guy who happened to find that money.
I got a bad feeling, Llewellyn.
Well, it's a mess, ain't it, Sheriff?
If it ain't, it'll do till the mess gets here.
I'm looking for Llewellyn Moss.
You go up to his trailer?
Yes.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Youth Critic Retrospective. I am your host, Cale Smith. Joining me today is Brandon Cooley.
Everyone.
And for the season finale of the five-part mini-series covering the 2008 Oscars, we are finally here to talk about the Oscar winner of 2008, and that is none other than No Country for Old Men. Yep.
The weirdest movie to ever win Best Picture. The most surprising, I would say.
You're thinking it's the weirdest?
Maybe. In terms of what they usually vote for, maybe the weirdest. It's not a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. Very good thing that it won. But because, I mean, I would say that it's where the Crash won, but for a different reason. This is the most unlikely movie to win Best Picture, maybe, is the best way to put it.
I would say Crash was the most unlikely, but still won, because that whole year it was seemingly going to be a Brokeback Mountain's year. The problem, yep. But somehow, some way, Crash won. I think it was the original screenplay, and Best Picture. But
I meant, given what the movie's about, I wouldn't be surprised if Crash winning Best Picture. Just because it's about, you know, the themes of racism and that kind of screenplay, you know. It's a movie with simple themes as compared to, like, something like this. You know, it's more surprising this would win Best Picture. I'd more likely, like, expect to see it win, like, the Palme d'Or, you know. This is the kind of movie that wins, like film festivals, not really the Oscars.
It's kind of odd, because we were talking about this last week as well with There Will Be Blood, and that film also is a kind of movie that normally would not be cherry-picked for Oscars. Mm-hmm. Normally, the films that would be cherry-picked are movies like Michael Clayton and Atonement. Of the other movies that were nominated, those were the ones that we cherry-picked. Even a movie like Juno would have been normally, like... I honestly think if Knocked Up came out in December, it would have probably taken Juno's place.
Yeah.
That's really what I think. And that's not a dig on either film. It's just, I think both movies are doing the same thing. They're just doing it in different styles.
Yeah.
It's interesting looking back at No Country for Old Men, because it's a movie that is slow, it's meditative, and it ends in the, like, least, I don't want to say least compelling way, but it ends in a way that just, it disappoints everyone, or it doesn't leave you sad.
Oh, not me.
Well, it doesn't leave you with a happy ending. And it leaves you on an ambiguous note, because you have no idea what happened to the wife. you and Anton Sugar was not the person that killed Lewin. It was just a gang. It was just a gang that was also following them. So it was a completely different group of people that we have not been following, chasing that killed Lewin. And on top of that, Tommy Lee Jones's character is really like, it really is more of his story anyway, even though the protagonist, the person we are rooting for to survive, is Josh Brolin, or we're relating to is Josh Brolin's character. So it just,
I've seen this several times, and actually when you start watching it for the second or third time, you start noticing really interesting things. Like, for example, there really is no protagonist in this movie. You could say there's three, really.
Because, I mean, there's people we're following.
Yeah, there's people we're following, but normally you would say that Josh Brolin is a protagonist because what he does is prompts the whole plot, you know, him finding the money. That's a classic MacGuffin, you know, he goes on the run. That's normal for movies to, you know, it's not that surprising for a movie to have that kind of plot. So you think he's the protagonist, but he does get killed off before, really at the start of the third act, or right in the middle of the third act, if I remember right. I can't remember the exact runtime, but
it's the last like 20 or 30 minutes of the movie.
Yeah. So there's still time before he's killed off soon enough to the point where the movie keeps going. And so you think, well, Tommy Lee Jones must be, but he's a passive protagonist. He doesn't really interact with he has no effect on the actual events of the movie in a lot of ways.
He's the observer of the environment.
Yeah, he's the observer, kind of like us. And of course, Sugar is the antagonist. But and then you even start noticing that what's really interesting is that these three main characters never come face to face in the same frame. They never even see each other. Actually, the only very brief glimpses of each other when in the chase scenes between Brolin and Javier Bardem.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fascinating because I've never seen a movie that has three like main characters essentially that never even talk to each other on screen.
Yep, they never.
That's like unheard of. That's
well, technically, Sugar and Lewin, they talk to each other on a phone, but yeah, they never share the screen.
Yeah, they never just are in the same frame though. It's always a chase movie where it's of course they talk to each other.
Cat and mouse movie.
Yeah. Which I'm not sure if that was intentional or just the way the screenplay was written based on the book, but yeah. Have you read any of the book before?
I have not read a Cormac McCarthy book.
I've started reading The Road and No Country for Old Men by Cormac McCarthy. I can't get into his writing style personally, which I know people really like him, but I read the first 10 pages of No Country for Old Men once. It didn't draw me in. I'm really surprised they picked this to be adapted because it's not, the book isn't that interesting from what I read. This is one of the best adaptations I've ever read of a book before because the Coen brothers did something really interesting with it.
They did. And well, they put their own flavor into it, which is, you know, if anyone watches Fargo or Miller's Crossing, and even I would even go and dare say Blood Simple.
You
feel their flavor in that. You feel like their flavor being, shot in there, and you just see it permeate all throughout the film. You see it through the dialogue. You see it through how the characters act. It's all like, it feels like a Coen Brothers film that just so happens to have the Cormac McCarthy like oppression, you know, realistic style.
Yeah, I would compare this more to Blood Simple than Fargo, because Fargo isn't a comedy, but it has, I would compare, like, Peter Stormare's character in Fargo he's funny the way he behaves. You know, he's a killer like Javier Bardem in this one, but the way that Peter Stormare, like, says his lines and the way he reacts to what's going on, you kind of have to laugh at, you know, like.
Right.
The banter between him and Steve Buscemi is just great, you know. In this one, it's mostly a drama with some comedic elements and kind of sprinkled in here and there. You know, it's like I like the mother or the grandmother. I'm not sure if it's the mother or grandmother of
Kelly
McDonald's character.
Mm-hmm.
It's the mom. Okay, I like her character. There's a line she says in the movie where talking about El Paso, and she's like, I don't know anybody from El Paso. I've never been to El Paso. It's just going on and on, complaining about having to leave. It's perfect. Like, because Coen Brothers can write that kind of dialogue, you know.
It is. They understand how people, particularly in the Midwest, talk. And I think that's always been important in their movies, is because it adds, I don't want to say, I guess it's okay to say, it adds a sense of realism to the world they're, to their kind of romanticized world they're building.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's one of the things I've always admired about the Coens, is that they create this kind of hyperbolic world, and for their characters to kind of interact in, and we just see how those interactions build a story and build them as characters. And that's what I've always been attracted to whenever I see a Coen Brothers movie, even if it's not great. Like I'm still one of like 10 people in the world that don't like Inside Llewyn Davis. Like I'm still, and I,
I never seen that one. So,
yeah. And I'm still on the fence about Burn After Reading. So
I like Burn After Reading.
I don't know. It's just like,
it's not in their top five, but it's good though.
It's kind of like Inherent Vice, where it's just, I mean, it's more sensical than Inherent Vice, but it's so, but there's a lot of random things that happen in Burn After Reading that are just like, it could have just been cut out of the movie.
Yeah. Like, well, I thought it was funny, you know, and I mean, they're good comedy at the end of the day, so I like that.
Sure.
It's not as good as the other movies by far, though. It's on the, I've seen maybe 10 by them, and it's probably on the lesser, it's definitely in the lesser five, the you know.
So, while we're on this, what are your top five favorite Coen Brothers movies?
Number one would be between this and Fargo. That's one of the big movie questions, like, you know, what's the best movie of 2007, you know, between this or There'll Be Blood, and what's, you know, the best Coen Brothers movie. I'd say probably this one, only because I've seen this one more times than Fargo, but maybe Fargo, I don't know. I have to watch it again and see. Third place would be, let me think, probably Big Lebowski for its rewatchability. It's a pretty good movie. And that's another very random movie that's also just very funny. The screenplay is, you'd say it's flawed, but I think it's all great. Number four, probably Barton Fink. And then, I haven't seen that in a while, actually. I need to watch that again. And then, actually, number four would be Blood Simple, and then number five would be Barton Fink. Yeah. That's probably the top five.
I have not seen every Coen Brothers movie, but I have enough to make a top five. Fargo is number one, then The Big Lebowski, and then this movie, and number four, I just had it, Raising Arizona is number four.
Yeah.
That movie is fantastic, and it's not just a wacky comedy with, you know, two great character actors playing a mom and a dad. It's actually, you know, there's something more to it, and I think that's the movie where the Coens were trying to find their way into how to do commentary or social commentary into their movies.
Yeah.
I just really dig Raising Arizona. It's a great film. And then number five, it's either Oh Brother, Where Art Thou or True Grit. I love True Grit, and I love them.
Yeah, True Grit wouldn't be my top five. It's good, but I wasn't like, I remember seeing that and expecting more because I've just watched all these great Coen Brothers movies. Maybe that was the reason why I didn't like as much. I'm not like interested in like, yeah, something about that, like the ending didn't really interest me. I don't know, something about True Grit didn't really catch my interest when I first saw it. I may have to watch it again, but it was good though. Yeah.
It's a good remake. It's one of the, I'll say this, it's one of the better remakes.
Well, if you remake a John Wayne movie, it's immediately going to be better because, I mean,
come on.
He's the worst actor in American film. When I was watching we were at I was at work lot yesterday in the break room. They had a John Wayne movie on. Well, I mean, he's made 50 movies, so I'm not sure which one it was. I've only seen a few, but he is just awful, though. I mean, awful as a person and awful as an actor. He is just terrible. It's like he's just a walking. It's almost like he's playing a person that would imitate him, like in the same way that like De Niro impersonators impersonate De Niro. If De Niro started acting like them, that's what John Wayne is. Like, it's just the weirdest thing that people like him so much. Like, The Searchers is just terrible. I people love it, but in terms of Westerns, like, I can't, I don't know what they're seeing in that movie, but I don't know. That's a tangent, but.
Have you ever seen Rio Bravo?
No, I haven't.
That's probably my favorite John Wayne movie.
Well, but have you seen The Searchers? Like,
no, and
that's an extremely highly rated movie, and I watched it, and it's like, what is this? Like, it's like, it's, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not gonna. I would say they're of their time. The John Wayne and John Ford films. I would say they're of their time. I think the reason why they probably do or do not hold up as well as they do is because of just the tech and the techniques they had working for them at the time.
Sure, but at the same time, though, John Ford made The Grapes of Wrath, which is a fantastic movie for 1940. And I know he can direct drama. I know he can direct, like, I mean, that's a movie with a lot of, you know, empathy and characters with, you know, well-developed. It's a great book, too, from what I've heard. So I know they were capable of more back then. And I think that those Westerns live on just because they're so famous and people saw them so much. I don't think they really have anything to offer in terms of great filmmaking. But
careful what you say, Brandon.
Hey, I'll debate that any time of day. Like, same thing with Gone with the Wind. I want to, you know, technically next year will be the 80th anniversary of Gone with the Wind. I would love to, I might do a video of that because that's another movie that I was completely blown away by how bad it was when I saw it, but another tangent for another day, but yeah.
Got to read that 1000 page book.
Yeah. Well, no, that'll be happening.
Oh my God. So would you say No Country for Old Men is a Western?
No, I would not, because a lot of people call, they like to do this thing where they take modern movies. Well, technically it's not modern because it's 1980, I think, but they take these movies and they say it's like a Western, but I consider a Western to take place between like the Civil War and 1910, roughly. It has horses, it has cowboys or some, you know, bounty hunters, outlaws. The people talk, you know, take small towns, people, has a different culture, obviously, because it takes place in that era. Having a movie that takes place in Texas about a drug deal gone wrong, it technically isn't a Western. They're taking different, like, elements of a Western, which is awesome. But
would neo-Western fit better then?
Maybe, if that's a thing. I mean, because there's a lot of movies people call that. Like, they called Logan a Western. There's a lot of movies they call that.
Hell or High Water is considered. I think that one's more considered neo Western.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a heist movie, but yeah.
Right.
I mean, I guess it's fine if people say that, but like, I don't think it makes a movie better to. I mean, it depends on the kind of movie. Because I didn't like Hell or High Water very much. I thought it was okay, but
no,
it's no, it was fine. It was one of those things where the hype, like, I kind of like was hyped for it and I saw it and didn't really think it was all that great, but it was fine. But
dude, Tyler Sheridan's pretty popular for our generation of screenwriters. Like, he's been his scripts for Sicario, Hell or High Water, and what was that recent one? Wind River. Those are very popular with us.
Yeah. Oh, I loved the script for Sicario. I didn't like the script for Hell or High Water. That's the part I didn't like about it, actually.
Okay.
All of it, yeah. But another conversation for another day. Yeah,
I think we'll talk more about Taylor Sheridan on the show when Sicario 2 comes out, or Soldado. Oh,
yeah.
So do we have any more thoughts on the movie No Country for All Men? Because it's a great film and I highly recommend it. And I think it deserved it, even though There Will Be Blood is the more epic, more well-crafted film, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But I think the win for Best Picture was mostly deserved.
Yeah. This is my favorite of the year. This is probably my top 50 movies of all time. I saw this when I was 13 or 14. When I first saw it, I saw it most as a thriller. But when you keep watching it, though, you notice things that you didn't notice before, especially when you're younger. Like the fact that he is a Vietnam War veteran. So, and that alone makes his motivations. It makes it, everything kind of makes sense when you think in that context, because this is a guy who feels like, you know, he's working class, feels like he's been cheated out on the way that a lot of, you know, Vietnam War veterans probably felt at the time.
Right.
Depending on their views of the war. So him taking the money and running, it makes sense. And he thinks that he can get away with it and actually survive. And someone with that, I mean, it makes sense when you think about the context of when it takes place. You just kind of notice different things about the movie each time you watch it, small details that you didn't notice before. I think of something. Yeah, like, for example, the scene in the hotel when he shoots through the door and jumps out the window. If you turn up the volume really high, the sound design is so well done, you can actually hear the light bulb being taken out. The small squeak of the light bulb when the Shigar takes it and turns off the lights, you know, stuff like that's great. You know, it's a great thriller.
It is. It's a really good cat and mouse thriller. Javier Bardem giving an excellent performance as Anton Shigar, and it's just really good movie. Really well done. So before we go, we have to...
Actually, before we go to that part, can I go on my theory about No Country for Old Men and Terminator? My insane theory that I've been talking about for you. Okay, so my theory...
Wait, I have not heard this theory, so go.
Oh, you haven't?
No.
Oh, okay, I thought I told you before. Okay, so the theory is that No Country for Old Men is the first Terminator movie because Anton Chigurh acts like Terminator, you know, like the way that Arnold Schwarzenegger acts in the first Terminator, right? So Terminator is made in 1984, so it's assumed it takes place in 84. This is made in 1980, so maybe the money that was being stolen here during the drug deal was the money used to invest in the company. What's the company's name, Terminator?
Skynet,
yes. It was the money used to invest in Skynet, and it was the machine sent back Anton Chigurh to make sure the money was stolen and invested in the company to create the Terminators. That's the first. Maybe that's the. It all connects, you know.
That is.
I'm joking. I'm not really serious, but he acts like a Terminator. In my defense, he, you know, that's, it's a joke, but yeah.
Oh boy, we would.
I'm gonna make a YouTube video. I'm gonna do a YouTube video of that someday, and it'll be fun. But
it's that's pretty good, but. Again, we're messing up the paradox here, the paradox here.
Yeah,
that's pretty good. So
it'll be a good clickbait video.
It will be, much like those other film theorist videos.
Pretty much, yeah.
So before we, you know, check out, I think we usually do this at the beginning of every show, but we kind of just went into the movie here. But we missed the what it was nominated for and what it actually won for. We did mention it won Best Picture, but it also won Best Director and Best Adapted Screenplay. Hang on just a second. Let me pull that back up. And
Supporting Actor.
Supporting Actor. And then, yeah, those were the four wins. And then it was nominated for... it was nominated for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7,
cinematography and editing.
Eight other award. It was nominated for four other awards. It was nominated for Best Cinematography, Roger Deakins. Obviously, he was competing himself with The Assassination of Jesse James and The Coward of Robert Ford.
Yeah.
And still lost to Robert Elswit. And then, of course, the Coens got an editing nomination, and then it got a nomination in sound mixing and sound editing. Do you think it should have won any of those technical awards?
Best editing, I would say probably it should have won. As good as the Bourne Ultimatum is in terms of editing, it's hard to say because, the editing in Bourne Ultimatum is impressive because of the action, the way that how fast-paced it is. But the editing in No Country for Old Men, the pacing is what matters in that movie. And the pacing is very well done because usually slow-paced movies like that drag on, you know. But the way they make it slow-paced but then catch up and speed up when the action starts to happen is really impressive, the way they go back and forth kind of between the two. And the, but, yeah.
Yeah. It's tough because I'm looking at the best sound, best editing, and they're all, you know, I'm looking at these movies and I'm like, they all deserve it. Like, they all deserve the Oscar. Because if you individually watch any of these movies that were nominated for best sound, best editing, best cinematography, you just understand any of these movies just to hear the sound or analyze the cinematography or analyze the editing choices for any of these movies, it works. Like, they all work in unison to the film. They all service the film.
Yeah.
The best of their ability. So it is tough. Like, it's always tough to be like, what should have won? Like, technical awards are always tough because I always feel like that whenever we make a top five of these, it's like, we just hand the Oscar to all five of these films because they're all just fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But in terms of most years and compared to most years, it's actually a pretty good year for giving the award to something that deserves it, because a lot of movies that get the best cinematography and best editing award don't deserve it at all whatsoever. I mean, like, the movies that have won best editing in the past usually don't have good editing at all, in my opinion. Or it's fine editing, but it's just not really, like, impressive in any way. You know, like, they usually should give it to the best picture winner. Like Crash won best editing, which I would argue has bad editing, from what I remember of it. As good as Argo was, I didn't think the editing was really that great, you know? It was fine, but what else? There's a lot of movies that have won, and same thing with cinematography. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but... Gravity and Avatar won best cinematography, and Life of Pi. There was some at... Life of Pi maybe deserved it a bit more, but in Avatar and Gravity, it's all CGI, so I was really surprised that it won cinematography, but... Personally, but
all of it's hard work. Like, all the work that went into those movies, like, there was hard work, there was effort to make those beautiful images, but you're right, it was all shot on a computer, or it was all, like, done in, or most of it, like, it, or I guess I'm trying to say it all heavily relied on a computer. And yeah, as we know, you can make something really beautiful anyway on a computer anyway. But then again, you know, Roger Deakins uses the digital intermediate color correction a lot, almost all in his film, on all of his movies since, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And he uses it to make his images just more perfect. So it's always tough, but I kind of agree that Roger Deakins should have won a long time ago. And
yep. I think for Sicario, that Sicario was the one he should have won for, I think, because what won in 2015? I should know this.
that was Sicario.
Yeah, no, he should have won for that one. What actually won in 2015? It was the, what was it? It was Revenant.
Right.
It was Revenant, which is great, but, you know, we've seen, you know, continuous takes before, and it's all great, but
don't doubt Emmanuel Lubezki.
Yeah, he's good, but well, he shouldn't have won for Gravity for sure, but he should have definitely won for Children of Men. That's his best movie, best work. He deserved it for Birdman, but yeah, Revenant, it's good, but Scar should have gotten it.
Yeah, I would say he probably should have won for Skyfall, mostly because that was his first digital film, and that was during a time when digital was still like in experimental mode. Digital cinematography had already been nominated before in Slumdog Millionaire, but the thing about Deakins though is that the way he photographs Skyfall and the way he uses digital technology, it completely elevates the movie in a way that no one thought digital cameras could at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, my pick for winning Best Cinematography that year was Django Unchained. Skyfall was good. I mean,
well, if we talk about Robert Richardson's DP work, he might as well just win for everything.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah, he's my favorite cinematographer.
We might as well just get a bunch of statues and just throw it at him for money.
Yeah, I would actually say Spectre has better cinematography than Skyfall, if I was comparing James Bond movies, but...
It's really good. I'm not saying... I wouldn't say anything bad about Von Hoytema's DP work, but I think there's just something really... I think Deakins just did something really special with Skyfall.
Yeah. It's actually... People love Skyfall the most. That's actually my third favorite James Bond movie out of the Daniel Craig ones. Casino Royale and Spectre take the top two spots, but
you with your hot takes.
What's that?
You with your that's. Do you know what a hot take is?
I think I do. What do you mean by a hot take, though? In this case,
you're just bringing up you're just bringing up unpopular
opinion. Yeah. I like doing that because we can't really go on a debate about it. But yeah, I like pulling up. People like Spectre, though. I don't think it's really hated by the... It's not hated in the same way Quantum of Solace is.
It's very disappointing compared to Skyfall and what Skyfall was like building up.
I would say Quantum of Solace is disappointing compared to what the others are like. Spectre is still pretty good. You know, my problem with Skyfall is that they're trying to give James Bond like a really emotional past of like having like a living in a foster home. And it's like, you know... It's James Bond. I don't think we need to carve in too deep. I think Casino Royale kind of established the reason why he is the way he is. But yeah, I don't know. That's just me.
Well, he is. I want to agree, but the problem is, what else do you do with Bond? That's the problem. Yeah. That's the problem. Like, there's only so many different ways you can play Bond before it gets tired out. And for me, it's like, I thought Skyfall was like the new way to do it, you know, with Craig and doing basically a whole trilogy of what was going to two more movies that were going to follow Spectre, or not Spectre, Skyfall. But I don't know. But to me, Spectre just... For what it's worth, and it just for me, Spectre is one of those movies where it's not a bad movie, but it needed another hand in the editing room or in the writer's room. Like, it just needed some more. It needed more time to work on it because it just feels like a first draft.
To connect this with No Country for Old Men, wrap it around. Javier Bardem is the best part of Skyfall, and he's the best Bond villain.
I'll agree to that
because he's just a great. He's just a great actor. He just improves with everything he's in. But that's the only part of Skyfall I was interested in actually. Not to talk about it too much, but like I wasn't interested in any of the things that were happening outside. Like the whole plot with him hacking into it. The problem with Skyfall is that it follows the same plot that the Joker and I guess technically Star Trek in the Darkness what came afterward, but that thing where the villain's captured and get because he wants to be and he gets out and it's like, we've seen that before. And
the Dark Knight plot device.
Yeah, that's basically they've been copying that a lot since then. The Avengers did too.
It's a good plot device.
It's getting kind of overdone. I don't know. I wasn't really interested in what was happening in Skyfall, except for his performance and a few action scenes. Yeah. But.
So, got anything else?
I think that's it. It's a great movie.
Yeah, I agree. It's a worth watching. And to be honest, all of these, I was actually surprised how many of these were all worth watching. I mean, look, the Oscars, I'll always say this, they don't always pick the best films, and there's always movies they could have rotated in and out of, you know, their top five, or I guess now top nine. However, occasionally they make mistakes, and occasionally they make mistakes like Crash or
Slumdog Millionaire.
No, that's not a mistake.
That's the worst one.
Incredibly, extremely loud and incredibly close. Whatever that one is. They make mistakes, but you know, or the
Shape of Water.
No,
which we will find out. We will find out here in a few days. Yeah, we got to do a. Yeah, I. Do you want to do a Three Billboards versus Shape of Water thing, or it's too soon for, or not enough time, I guess. So, you know, actually, what we should do it afterwards, after one of them wins, to see. I'll be more motivated to do it then.
I love The Shape of Water. You guys know it was I chose that as my number one of the year, but the thing is about Three Billboards is it's a good movie. It's just, it hasn't stuck with me in the sense, I think there's something about those other eight movies other than that have stuck with me very well.
I want Three Billboards to win because it'll be like No Country for Old Men. It'll be the most like unlikely movie to win Best Picture because it's so different from what's usually nominated. It's my second favorite of the year, second to Logan. I love Three Billboards. I like the characters are so well written in it that I think that's why it was nominated. And I hope that let's not get into the debate now, but yeah, I hope it wins. Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. It doesn't matter at the end of the day, but
I hope the Post wins.
Yeah, that's a good one too.
I was joking, but I mean, I don't know. We'll see. I really liked. It's not a bad list. Like, there's not a movie on that list this year that I was like, why did you pick that one, Oscars?
Yeah.
They were all really good.
Well, we got to remember the English Patient effect where 96, we all remember Fargo. And it's all like everybody loves it, but no one remembers English Patient. Like, I challenge one person to actually tell me the plot of English Patient today.
I've never seen it.
If you watched it, it would be like never having seen it. Because I've seen it before, and it's just really forgettable. It's not even terrible. It's just so forgettable that it's just amazing that people praised at the time.
It's exactly like the Seinfeld joke.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was going to mention that. There's a whole Seinfeld episode of her saying, "What are you guys thinking? It's not that good." You know, just it's really funny. Elaine. One of my favorite episodes.
That's one of mine too, because it's just like it is a great running gag that Elaine is wanting to see this one like goofy movie, and then her boss, her boyfriend, all are like, and everyone she takes the English every time she goes to England to see the English Patient, everyone's just like, this is the best damn movie ever, and yeah, it's just
well, the other great episode is the Schindler's List episode where Jerry and his girlfriend make out during the whole episode, and Newman tries to tell his parents about that. You pretty much are going to hell if you make out during Schindler's List. That's pretty much guaranteed. But it is so funny, just the way they make fun of like these. In that case, it's a great movie. But yeah, they take their comedy in interesting directions for sure.
I definitely, and the other favorite Seinfeld, and this will be one of our final notes, I love the Chinese restaurant episode. That is funny, relatable. It's a little dated because some of those problems can now be solved by cell phones.
It's about nothing. That's the whole point of the show.
Encompasses
the whole show.
Oh yeah, it doesn't take away, but it's still like it's a nice relic.
Yeah,
nice relic of the 90s. So, with that said, Brandon, do you have any more thoughts on this Oscar retrospective series, or are you ready to close out?
Nah, probably all we had to say about 2007.
It's a good season.
Jodie actually got nominated for more, but that's about it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
That's about the last, yeah.
At least for screenplay or direction, like something.
So yeah, something. That's their only mistake, though, I think, that year. They did a pretty good job, which is rare for the Oscars.
Yeah. Oh, well. So with that said, Brandon, you still don't have any social media yet?
No, the YouTube channel is Lemon Bat, but I've got like 3 videos on there. Okay. So we may have more soon, but nah, not really.
All right, I'll still put a link in the description of this podcast, and you can find me on Twitter at MovieKale. You can also follow the podcast at Youth Critic, and you can also follow the channel that distributes this podcast at KHG Network. Thanks, everyone. We will be back with you. In terms of the retrospectives, we'll be back soon. I have a couple more ideas cooking up, but for now, we're just going back to the original regular podcast programming. So thanks, everyone. We'll be back with you. We'll be back with you on the retrospective side very soon.
Do you want to leave a message?
Yes.
If I don't come back, you tell Mother I love her.
Your mother's dead.
Well, then I'll tell her myself. I've got a loose cannon here.
You think this boy Moss has got any notion of the sorts that are hunting him?
I don't know. He ought to. He's seen the same things I've seen, and it certainly made an impression on me.
Just how dangerous is he?
Compared to what? The bubonic plague?
The crime you see now, it's hard to even take its measure.
It's just all out war.
You can't stop what's coming. Is this guy supposed to be the ultimate badass?
You don't understand.
Call it.